This is Susan Livingston reporting for Sequitur for Expressions of Peace Radio. Expressions of Peace. Personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived under the Expressions of Peace tab at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action. With habitat loss, ecological collapse, and consequent impending extinction as its main themes, Sequitur is a discussion of the natural consequences of actions at the individual, community, cultural, and species levels. Sequitur, it follows. Sequitur, the theme song, is by Zymphd. That's Z-Y-M-P-H-T. You can find more of his music on SoundCloud. Sequitur originated as the Global Extreme Weather segment on Extinction Radio. The weather and climate news felt too urgent to abandon when Extinction Radio went on hiatus last spring, so Sequitur became a freestanding podcast. Inspired by Guy McPherson's Nature Bats Last, the focus of Sequitur expanded beyond extreme weather events and natural disasters to consider the overarching issue of habitat loss. Sequitur's content further expanded under the influence of Derek Jensen's book The Myth of Human Supremacy to cover extinction events and their drivers for the whole web of life rather than only property destruction and loss of human life or monetized livelihood. Aho, Mitakwe Owasan, we are all related.
Hello, everybody. It's Benjamin the Donkey. You know, our intelligent innovation, new elements with radiation, does not seem so smart when you see it's a part of our premature termination. With bombs and reactors we've topped, the food chain and all we co-opt. Now we are captive to a world radioactive, 'cause Judgment Day cannot be stopped. We've not yet learned being resolved more to clean up this deadly unsolved chore. But that's not astounding. Radioactive surrounding is not the world which we evolved for. We know that the grid will soon fail, causing radioactive travail. We can end life creation, but our radiation will keep on spreading death and prevail. If reactors aren't shut down post-haste, and fuel rods deeply encased, prepare for bye-bye, because we're likely to die in hot radioactive waste. Hee-haw!
I know, right? I mean, it's not like we didn't know. Fukushima was an unnatural disaster caused by greed and hubris. Greed for unlimited energy with the relatively small economic cost of nuclear production, and hubris in operating such facilities in such a vulnerable location, so close to high-density population centers, despite the enormous human cost when, not if, an accident occurs. But before I give you the in-depth report on Fukushima, I want to acknowledge the 38th anniversary of the disaster at the Three Mile Island Nuclear Power Plant at Middletown, Pennsylvania, that occurred on 28 March 1979, with a summary report. The 31st anniversary of Chernobyl is at the end of next month, so we'll be returning a third time to the topic of unnatural disaster as a driver of the sixth extinction in general and near-term human extinction in particular. But for now, let's just own that those two predate Fukushima by a generation and a half, and we are still operating under the misguided notion that if we simply use money to reward the victims and punish the perpetrators, all will be well. The Nuclear Energy Institute's 53-member board of directors includes representatives of nuclear utilities and fuel cycle companies, as well as plant designers, architects, and engineers. I would imagine that places them in the pro-nuclear camp. Their findings indicate that the accident at Three Mile Island occurred at a moment when Reactor 2 was operating at 100% capacity. Flat out, in other words, already a dangerous proposition. A pump failed, pressure and temperature built up, a relief valve opened as intended to allow excess water and steam to escape to a holding tank in the basement, but it failed to close when pressure returned to normal. So water continued to escape, leaving the fuel rods high and dry, and the temperature soared. Meanwhile, operators were getting erroneous readings that indicated that the valve was closed and were thus unaware of the critical situation until 50% of the fuel was melted down. In addition, vibration caused by the buildup of steam was damaging the system, and when operators finally replenished the coolant, it shattered some of the remaining fuel rods. All of the fuel rods were damaged to some extent. As a result, quote, 700,000 gallons of radioactive cooling water ended up in the basement of the reactor building and in tanks in the auxiliary building, contaminating them. In addition, a small amount of radioactive material was released into the atmosphere from the ventilation stack of an auxiliary building to relieve pressure inside the reactor building, close quote. But the report continues with a bold section heading that declares that there were, quote, no measurable health effects, unquote, and goes on to catalog studies on deaths, injuries, and cancer risk to humans. A federal appeals court in December 2003 dismissed the consolidated cases of some 2,000 plaintiffs seeking damages against the plant's former owners for health problems they alleged the accident had caused. The court said the plaintiffs had failed to present evidence that they had received a radiation dose large enough to cause possible health effects. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission called upon the National Academy of Sciences to provide a review of cancer incidence and mortality risk among people living near operating, decommissioned, or proposed nuclear facilities in order to update the National Cancer Institute's 20-year-old report. But funding for that study was withdrawn by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission in 2015. After spending $1.5 million of the projected $8 million budget for what was meant to be a 10-year study, citing studies done elsewhere that found no increased health risk to humans from living near a nuclear power plant. In defense of that huge budget, I'd like to point out that effects are difficult to measure due to demographic factors such as the extreme mobility of the population. However, returning to the Nuclear Energy Institute report, quote, people who suffered financial losses as a result of the precautionary evacuation following the incident were promptly paid, demonstrating the effectiveness of the industry's liability insurance protection under the Price-Anderson Act. In addition, businesses were compensated for loss of revenue, and the state and local community were compensated for the expenses incurred during the response to the threat. Close quote. Say what? It looks like financial losses were compensated by means of insurance claims without court intervention, but quality of life issues are essentially ignored. Oh, sure, they put the plant on ice after a 4.5-year cleanup process was completed, but area residents are still holding their breath since the final decommissioning is not due to be completed for another 35 years. Say what? That's because it's more efficient and cost-effective to decommission both reactors at once, and TMI-1's operating license has been renewed. Meanwhile, there have been divestitures and mergers in the ownership of the facility such that accountability is unclear. In fact, a post-shutdown decommissioning activities report due in 1995 was submitted 18 years late with just a nod-nod, wink-wink on the part of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. I agree with Eric Epstein, spokesperson for the TMI Alert Watchdog Group, when he says that TMI will never be decommissioned due to the fact that the problem of storage of the radioactive waste remains unresolved. Can you say NIMBY? Not in my backyard. This is an acronym alert. In an ironic twist of fate, the acronym TMI has been adopted in text messaging culture as a gag order. It stands for too much information. When it comes to radioactive pollution, it's hard to imagine that there could be such a thing as too much information. In the immediate aftermath of the nuclear accident, the commission mandated by President Jimmy Carter recommended standards and training for operators and supervisors but left implementation of their recommendations in the hands of the industry. What could possibly go wrong? The industry responded by creating the Institute of Nuclear Power Operations. By 1985, the Institute had created the National Academy for Nuclear Training and is now claiming that, quote, the nation's 104 operating reactors maintain high levels of safety and reliability, as evidenced by the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's Reactor Oversight Program and performance indicators tracked by the World Association of Nuclear Operators, unquote. All things considered, I guess we've been incredibly lucky and we're living on borrowed time. Activists continue to call for further epidemiological studies on the effects of radiation on human health. Epstein says, quote, the Nuclear Regulatory Commission's decision not to study cancer risks near nuclear reactors is a stark reminder that the Commission places the economic health of the industry above the well-being of people who live and work near reactors and waste sites. The Nuclear Regulatory Commission's retreat from examining the health consequences of folks who live and work near nuclear power plants warrants an investigation by the Government Accountability Office as to who and what pressured the Nuclear Regulatory Commission to pull the plug on this study. Nuclear plants do not maintain a cancer registry for their workers or track health consequences of their operations on local communities. This study was a critical tool that would have provided data and information regarding the harmful impacts of nuclear power operations, unquote. In contrast to official claims, Beyond Nuclear, another activist group, says that, quote, study after study in Europe has shown a clear rise in childhood leukemia around operating nuclear power facilities, unquote. I repeat, operating nuclear power facilities. This is very interesting, since the official claims are based on before and after comparisons, which would naturally not be significant if the effect predates the accident, is independent of leakage, is caused by proximity to the power plant. Perhaps it's stress resulting from the threat of radiation exposure that can increase somatic mutation and therefore cancers. And we're not hearing anything about the conception difficulties and miscarriage rates that Yumi Kikuchi referenced in her interview for Sequitur on Natural Disaster 1 that speak clearly of germ cell mutations, or about birth defects such as we see in the Persian Gulf as a result of the use of depleted uranium munitions, also attributable to germ cell mutations. But that's enough on 3 Mile Island. Now I'm going to pass the mic to Benjamin the Donkey to shift the focus back to Fukushima so I can bring you the 2012 report I promised last time from Japan's Nuclear Accident Independent Investigation Commission and some additional comments from the panel discussion at Cornell University in March 2016 about lessons learned from our 3 major unnatural disasters. Benji?
You know, they had some nuclear meltdowns a few years ago in Fukushima, Japan, and for a while there was a bit of concern. As we now know, nothing came of the whole thing, and everything's fine. But back then, some sillies thought stuff like, what if there was another earthquake while the spent fuel pools were being unloaded? 'Twas a dark and stormy night, the kind that makes you feel fright. When the earthquake hit where some fault plane was split and began everybody's plight. Some rods by the quake thus goaded fell from where they'd been loaded. They rumbled and tumbled and crumbled all jumbled. Then the whole thing exploded. For those nearby when it struck, the whole event didn't suck. No one felt sick. Vaporization works quick. The rest of the world had less luck. So back where this story began, getting scared was part of the plan. But don't worry your ass, this won't come to pass unless there's a quake in Japan. Hee-haw!
Thank you, Benji. And by the way, in August 2014, Japan Today reports that scientists were predicting another major Fukushima earthquake by 2017, and sure enough, in the pre-dawn hours of 22 November 2016, while we were preoccupied with our broken democratic process, lame electoral outcome, and the ongoing Federal Circus Act, a magnitude 6.9 quake occurred with an epicenter a little more than 1 degree to the southwest of the 11 March 2011 quake. This was judged to be a delayed aftershock from the 11 March 2011 quake and affected the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant, where there was a power failure of less than 2 hours, not long enough to create a meltdown. The resulting tsunami was less than 1.5 meters. Radiation levels were unchanged. There were no deaths, and there was no impact on Japanese economic markets. But the psychological impact of this and the rest of the ongoing quakes and shakes is highly significant to a people still reeling from apocalyptic disaster. Another one struck at the end of December with a magnitude of 5.9 and no tsunami. And just this past Friday, at the other end of the country, Okinawa, Yumi's family's first evacuation destination, got hit with a magnitude 5.1 quake. Talk about living on borrowed time. Every resident of the region is probably diagnosable with PTSD and other illnesses on the adrenal fatigue spectrum due to living in a state of constant hypervigilance. And it's all in the name of generating more power than we need while advancing capacity for nuclear weapons. We are so addicted, and we still haven't taken that first step of admitting that our lives have become unmanageable. Our lives and the lives of all the other beings on the planet, with the possible exception of some sponges or fungi or other single-celled organisms. And now, before I launch into the Nuclear Accident Independent Investigation Commission report, let's pause and take a few deep breaths while we listen to some poetry.
Hi, it's Debbie Kell Earnshaw here, with some words of wisdom from William Blake's The Marriage of Heaven and Hell. The roaring of lions, the howling of wolves, the raging of the stormy sea, and the destructive sword are portions of eternity too great for the eye of man. The fox condemns the trap, not himself. Joys impregnate, sorrows bring forth. The bird, a nest, the spider, a web, man, friendship. What is now proved was once only imagined. The rat, the mouse, the fox, the rabbit, watch the roots. The lion, the tiger, the horse, the elephant, watch the fruits. A fool sees not the same tree that a wise man sees. In seed time, learn. In harvest, teach. In winter, enjoy. Eternity is in love with the productions of time. The most sublime act is to set another before you.
Thank you, Debbie Kale Earnshaw. That was refreshing. The Nuclear Accident Independent Investigation Commission was the first independent commission chartered by the Japanese Diet, which is their old-time name for their legislature or parliament, in the history of their constitutional government. Mandated at the end of October 2011 and installed 6 weeks later, there were 10 members who held 19 meetings, of which all but the first were live-streamed with simultaneous translation into English, 1,167 interviews, and 3 town hall meetings within the evacuation perimeter, at which a total of more than 400 residents were heard. More than 10,000 survey responses were collected, and more than 170,000 comments were made on social media. However, the commission had no authority to make policy or process decisions of any kind going forward. The next summer, the commission published their exhaustive report of findings, including verbatim comments from the survey results. I reviewed the 88-page executive summary of the nearly 600-page document and was impressed by the thoroughness and the humility. From the introduction, quote, "What must be admitted, very painfully, is that this was a disaster made in Japan. Its fundamental causes are to be found in the ingrained conventions of Japanese culture, our reflexive obedience, our reluctance to question authority, our devotion to sticking with the program, our groupism, and our insularity. Had other Japanese been in the shoes of those who bear responsibility for this accident, the result may well have been the same." Unquote. The commission verified that on 11 March 2011, the structure of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant was not capable of withstanding the effects of the earthquake and the tsunami. In spite of the fact that TEPCO and the regulators were aware of the risk from both earthquake and tsunami, neither had taken steps to put preventive measures in place or to develop a response to a catastrophic accident. This lack of preparation was the direct and foreseeable cause of the severity of this accident. Prevention and mitigation measures were recommended but not mandated at least 5 years prior, most especially after the fall of the World Trade Center in the U.S. Thus, the magnitude of the disaster was due to corporate, regulatory, and government neglect, collusion, and obfuscation. Yet stronger regulations and precautions would have been tantamount to admitting to higher risk and would therefore have increased the insurance expense. The commission delivered a strong organizational indictment of TEPCO. They found that had there been a higher level of knowledge, training, and equipment inspection related to severe accidents, and had there been specific instructions given to the on-site workers concerning the state of emergency within the necessary time frame, a more effective accident response would have been possible. They further found that TEPCO did not fulfill its responsibilities as a private corporation, instead obeying and relying upon the Ministry of Economy, Trade, and Industry, the bureaucratic agency driving nuclear policy. At the same time, by virtue of its status within the Federation of Electric Power Companies, it contrived a cozy relationship with the regulators and took the teeth out of regulations. The commission recommended that TEPCO undergo fundamental corporate changes, including strengthening its governance, working towards building an organizational culture which prioritizes safety, and changing its stance on information disclosure. The commission closely investigated the development of the accident and studied whether the accident could have been contained as well as whether it could have become even more serious. They also examined the role of the earthquake as a cause of the accident and the validity of TEPCO's claim that the tsunami was the sole direct cause and concluded that TEPCO was too quick to cite the tsunami as the cause of the nuclear accident and deny that the earthquake caused any damage, that the loss of external power was due to the earthquake, not the tsunami. Once the total situation blackout occurred, including the loss of direct power source, it was impossible to change the course of events. The commission found a possibility that the earthquake damaged equipment necessary for ensuring safety and that a small-scale loss of coolant accident occurred in Unit 1. They recommended further investigation of these points. The commission made 7 specific recommendations with universal applicability to the conduct and regulation of high-risk commercial enterprises. Recommendation 1. The National Diet must monitor the nuclear regulatory body. The Fukushima nuclear power plant accident was the result of collusion between the government, the regulators, and TEPCO. They effectively betrayed the nation's right to be safe from nuclear accidents. Therefore, we conclude that the accident was clearly man-made. We believe that the root causes were the organizational and regulatory systems that supported faulty rationales for decisions and actions, rather than issues related to the competency of any specific individual. A permanent committee to deal with issues regarding nuclear power must be established in the National Diet in order to supervise the regulators to secure the safety of the public. Its responsibilities should be 1. to conduct regular investigations and explanatory hearings of regulatory agencies, academics, and stakeholders. 2. To establish an advisory body, including independent experts with a global perspective, to keep the committee's knowledge updated in its dealings with regulators. 3. To continue investigations on other relevant issues. And 4. To make regular reports on their activities and the implementation of their recommendations. Recommendation 2. Reform the crisis management system. The situation continued to deteriorate because the crisis management system of the Prime Minister's office, the regulators, and other responsible agencies failed to protect the health and safety of the public. The boundaries defining the roles and responsibilities of the parties involved were ambiguous. The residents' confusion over the evacuation stemmed from the regulators' negligence and failure over the years to implement adequate preventive measures against a nuclear disaster, as well as lack of crisis management preparation by previous governments and regulators. A fundamental re-examination of the crisis management system must be made, and the boundaries dividing the responsibilities of the national and local governments and the operators must be made clear. This includes 1. A re-examination of the crisis management structure of the government. A structure must be established with the consolidated chain of command and the power to deal with emergency situations. 2. National and local governments must bear responsibility for the response to off-site radiation release. They must act with public health and safety as the priority. And 3. The operator must assume responsibility for on-site accident response, including the halting of operations and reactor cooling and containment. Recommendation 3. Government is responsible for public health and welfare. The Commission recognizes that the residents in the affected area are still struggling from the effects of the accident. They continue to face grave concerns, including the health effects of radiation exposure, displacement, dissolution of families, disruption of lives and lifestyles, and the contamination of vast areas of the environment. There is no foreseeable end to the decontamination and restoration activities that are essential for rebuilding communities. Neither the government nor the regulators are fully committed to protecting public health and safety. They have not acted to protect the health of the residents and to restore their welfare. The following must be implemented as soon as possible. 1. A system must be established to deal with long-term public health effects, including stress-related illnesses. Medical diagnosis and treatment should be covered by state funding. Information should be disclosed with public health and safety as the priority instead of government convenience. This information must be comprehensive for use by individual residents to make informed decisions. 2. Continued monitoring of hotspots and the spread of radioactive contamination must be undertaken to protect communities and the public. Measures to prevent any potential spread should also be implemented. And 3. The government must establish a detailed and transparent program of decontamination and relocation, as well as provide information so that all residents will be knowledgeable about their compensation options. Recommendation 4. Monitor operations of nuclear power plants. In order to prevent the Federation of Electric Power Companies from being used as a route for negotiating with regulatory agencies, new relationships among the electric power companies must be established, built on mutual supervision and transparency. 1. The government must set rules and disclose information regarding its relationship with the operators. 2. Operators must construct a cross-monitoring system to maintain safety standards at the highest global levels. 3. TEPCO must undergo dramatic corporate reform, including governance, risk management, and information disclosure, with safety as the sole priority. And 4. All operators must accept an agency appointed by the National Diet as a monitoring authority of all aspects of their operations, including risk management, governance, and safety standards, with rights to on-site investigations.
You're listening to Sequitur, a production of Expressions of Peace, personal, powerful, and heart-to-heart. Sequitur is archived at panina.org. That's P-A-N-I-N-A, as in peace and nonviolence in action.
Recommendation 5. Transform the regulatory system in a fundamental and substantive way. The safety of nuclear energy in Japan and the public cannot be assured unless the regulators go through an essential transformation process. Japan's regulators must shed the insular attitude of ignoring international safety standards and transform themselves into a globally trusted entity. The new regulatory organization must be independent, transparent, professional, consolidated, and proactive. 1. Independent. The chain of command, responsible authority, and work processes must be independent from organizations promoted by the government, from operators, and from politics. 2. Transparent. The decision-making process should exclude the involvement of electric power operator stakeholders. Disclosure of the decision-making process to the National Diet is a must. The committee must keep minutes of meetings and all other negotiations with promotional organizations, operators, and other political organizations, and disclose them to the public. The National Diet shall make the final selection of the commissioners after receiving third-party advice. 3. Professional. Personnel must meet global standards. Exchange programs with overseas regulatory bodies must be promoted, and interaction and exchange of human resources must be increased. An advisory organization, including knowledgeable personnel, must be established. The no-return rule should be applied without exception. 4. Consolidated. The functions of the organizations, especially emergency communications, decision-making, and control, should be consolidated. 5. Proactive. The organizations should keep up with the latest knowledge and technology and undergo continuous reform activities under the supervision of the Diet. Recommendation 6. Reform and realign laws related to nuclear energy. Mechanisms must be established to ensure that the latest technological findings from international sources are reflected in all existing laws and regulations. Replacing people or changing the names of institutions will not solve the problems. Unless these root causes are resolved, preventive measures against future similar accidents will never be complete. 1. Existing laws should be consolidated and rewritten in order to meet global standards of safety, public health, and welfare. 2. The roles for operators and all government agencies involved in emergency response activities must be clearly defined. 3. Regular monitoring and updates must be implemented in order to maintain the highest standards and the highest technological levels of the international nuclear community. 4. New rules must be created that oversee the backfit operations of old reactors and set criteria to determine whether reactors should be decommissioned. Recommendation 7. Develop a system of independent investigation commissions. A system for appointing independent investigation committees, including experts largely from the private sector, must be developed to deal with unresolved issues, including but not limited to the decommissioning process of reactors, dealing with spent fuel issues, limiting accident effects, and decontamination. See what I mean about thoroughness and humility? Can you imagine such a document coming from a commission investigating a U.S. catastrophe, such as the fall of the World Trade Center or the assassination of President John Fitzgerald Kennedy? But according to Benjamin the Donkey, it's not rocket science. It's really quite simple, because WASF. Right, Benji?
Yeehaw! Tsunami and earthquake vibration? Workers try to fix the nuke station. They find that they can't and abandon the plant. Fukushima evacuation. Reactor and pool degradation threatens the population. Genetic mutation creates malformation. Tokyo evacuation. It's not just one single location, but everywhere in that nation. Plants aren't maintained, damage can't be contained. Japan evacuation. Worldwide plant disintegration spreads massive irradiation. Humans find out what's meant by extinction event. No evacuation. Yeehaw!
That was Zimft performing his Legacy of Sadness almost a quarter century ago. Sometimes I just have to pause for a moment to gather myself for what's to come. Japan's Nuclear Accident Independent Investigation Commission Chairman Kiyoshi Kurokawa, a physician by training, was one of three panelists who spoke at Cornell University on the fifth anniversary of the disaster last March. He had a great deal to say about aspects of Japanese culture that set the stage for this unnatural disaster. Of special interest to me as a psycholinguist were his reflections on accountability, a completely foreign concept in Japanese culture that is translated as the obligation to explain and results in extreme avoidance of individual responsibility. This is the polar opposite of the Western mindset, where demands for so-called justice require that blame be attached to some individual or relatively small group of individuals, and that punishment, usually of a monetary nature, be exacted. Kurokawa also spoke of the insularity of Japan and the lack of real-time process transparency, even with respect to their own citizens. For example, more than 700 proposals have been submitted for dealing with the ongoing problem of contaminated water, with more than 200 of those from abroad. But the proposals and the process for their review is classified information. However, I question whether this is a Japanese trait, and I further question whether John Q. Public has the time, interest, and expertise to evaluate all of that information, even if he had it. Kurokawa reports that a new regulatory body with 900 new bureaucrats was created as recommended by the commission, but the bureaucratic culture remains one of don't ask, don't tell. The other two panelists were Charles Perrow, Yale University Professor Emeritus and Stanford University Visiting Professor, and Sonia Schmidt of Virginia Polytechnic Institute and State University. Sonia Schmidt's expertise is on the Chernobyl disaster, so we'll hear more about her findings at the end of April. The 92-year-old Dr. Perrow made some startling disclosures that might have been headline news had we not been so distracted by U.S. electoral politics. He said, quote, "The Fukushima accident is not over, not by any means. The cancer rate in Japan is going to rise steadily, but it will be denied by the government because there is no transparency on this issue in Japan," end quote. He reports that Japan has passed a secrets law, whereby journalists can be imprisoned for reporting unapproved information about the health effects of the unnatural triple disaster. Perrow also disclosed some ill-advised cost-saving measures from the original site design and construction. Not only did they lower the hill so the plant would be closer to the source of cooling water, namely the ocean, but they situated the generators in the basement where they were even more vulnerable to flooding. In addition, they diverted a river uphill from the six power stations so that it would flow down either side of the area. Quote, "They never anticipated an earthquake could wreck their diversion. So now we have a strong underground river flowing directly under the plant, where three huge globs of molten fuel are sitting on the bottom, giving off radiation, and sending that radiation into the river that's underneath the plant, and it's going out into the ocean, and we're seeing damage in the marine life in the west coast of the United States and Canada. There's no way that's going to be stopped until they get the molten cores out of there, and they have no way of doing that. Nobody has any idea what to do about the continuing Fukushima contamination," unquote. So much for cheap energy. So what if nuclear power plants don't contribute to global warming? According to Wikipedia, quote, "As of June 2016, dispersed nuclear fallout and associated radiation contamination continue to pollute the environment," unquote. University of Melbourne Professor Tilman Ruff stated, quote, "Every day 300 tons of contaminated water leak from the crippled nuclear plant. The reconstruction agency states that 174,000 people have been unable to return to their homes. Ecological diversity has decreased and malformations have been found in trees, birds, and mammals," unquote. But we're supposed to believe that the health risks are negligible? There is no amount of compensation, adaptation, or mitigation that can change the fact that Japan is located on the Pacific Ring of Fire. Not only that, but Japan is on the subduction zone of not one, but two tectonic plates that make increasing frequency and magnitude of earthquakes more likely.
You know, not very far down the road, we're going to reap what we've sowed. The world will go cuckoo when everything's fuku and nuclear plants all explode. Hee-haw!
Thank you, Benji. That's exactly what I mean by the failure of the modelers of the world to take into account the impact on the system they are modeling of factors that originate in other systems. No wonder collapse is happening faster than previously predicted. I have recently come to realize that the exponential increase in CO2 concentration in our atmosphere must have a corresponding decrease in concentration of other elements, most notably oxygen. It's not enough of a change to trigger respiratory distress in otherwise healthy breathers, so we conclude that the oxygen level is still optimal, But what about non-visible effects on systems and functions that depend on dissolved oxygen in the blood, such as sensory alertness and cognitive acuity? I suspect that this is the reason why we derive such health benefit from renewing nature connection, that this is the wisdom behind the intuitive sense that so-called country air has health benefits to our increasingly urbanized population. And on a different note, atmospheric science has nothing to say about the status of nuclear power plants, especially those that are close to major population centers, as perhaps the most attractive terrorist targets on the planet. CGTN is a DC-based English-language news channel run by China Central Television. In an interview by anchor Anand Naidu in 2013, radiation expert Dr. Jeanette Sherman confirmed that the 300 tons per day of water emanating from Fukushima laced with radioactive cesium and strontium have a half-life of about 30 years. All other factors being equal, it takes 10 half-lives for each of these isotopes to reach negligible levels. But all other things are not equal. While the level is still smaller than the allowable level for drinking water, it becomes concentrated as it moves up the food chain. Of particular concern is strontium-90 due to its effects on bone tissue. As of 2014, no U.S. federal agency was funding offshore monitoring of radioactivity in the ocean. Under the direction of chemical oceanographer and founder Dr. Ken Buseler, the Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution, a crowd-funded science project in Oregon, has been measuring cesium-134 radiation levels since the Fukushima disaster. Due to its short half-life of just over 2 years, the contribution of cesium-134 radiation left over from nuclear testing in the 1960s and early 1970s is thought to be negligible. Thus, any cesium-134 detected is attributed to Fukushima. In early 2016, they detected cesium-134, the so-called fingerprint of Fukushima, on U.S. shores. More recently, as cesium-134 levels decay below detectability, measurements include cesium-137 levels, with its longer half-life of 30 years, with background levels from nuclear testing of past decades factored out statistically. Results are corroborated by University of Victoria chemical oceanographer Jay Cullen of the Fukushima Inform Project in Canada. On 12 December 2016, EnviroNews editor-in-chief Emerson Uri said, quote, "Medical science and epidemiological studies have demonstrated time and again that there is no safe amount of radiation for a living organism to be subjected to, period." Close quote. Uri said later in a statement, quote, "It's one thing for the media to regurgitate trivial facts on trivial matters, but to blindly repeat that consuming low levels of radiation is safe is irresponsible reporting and borders on dangerous. News editors should take care to do their due diligence on a matter as serious as leading readers to believe consuming any amount of radiation is safe, when medical science and epidemiology dating back 50 years to the present have demonstrated repeatedly that that's just not true. Even the smallest exposures increase the risk of cancer to the subject," close quote, which must be why technicians leave the room when performing medical x-rays. However, writing for Fox News Health, Dr. Alan Lockwood, MD, said that comparing Fukushima radiation levels with levels sustained in the course of medical x-rays is not a valid practice. Quote, "Consuming food containing radionuclides is particularly dangerous. If an individual ingests or inhales a radioactive particle, it continues to irradiate the body as long as it remains radioactive and stays in the body." Unquote. According to an LA Times obituary, the late Dr. John Goffman, professor emeritus at the University of California, Berkeley, and author of Nuclear Witnesses, Insiders Speak Out, together with his colleague at Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory, Arthur R. Tamplin, quote, "developed data in 1969 showing that the risk from low doses of radiation was 20 times higher than stated by the government. Their publication of the data, despite strong efforts to censor it, led them to lose virtually all of their research funding and eventually their positions at the government laboratory, end quote. Sound familiar? Their conclusions have been validated by subsequent research. Woods Hole Oceanographic Institution founder Dr. Ken Bousselier is the lead author of a report by a team of 12 scientists from coast to coast and around the world that was published in the January 2017 annual review of the journal Marine Science. Here are some key findings. Fukushima-derived radionuclides off the west coast of North America were documented as of June 2013. By February 2014, cesium-137 had increased to 2 becquerels throughout the upper 150 meters, double the residual amount from nuclear weapons tests. Contrary to predictions from the models, these amounts have continued to increase over time, as measured about 2,000 kilometers north of Hawaii, with offshore values approaching 6 becquerels in 2014 and 10 becquerels in 2015. The first arrival of Fukushima-derived radionuclides on the shoreline of North America was detected in February 2015 in British Columbia. One of the reasons for higher-than-predicted levels of cesium-137 may be related to relatively weak mixing and strongly positive temperature anomalies in the eastern North Pacific starting in 2013 and 2014, caused by an unusual weather pattern that featured abnormally high sea level pressure over this region. Two time series sediment traps that were in place and detecting no cesium prior to March 2011 started detecting the radionuclides so soon after the disaster that the only possible conclusion is an atmospheric fallout source. Differences in arrival times of the cesium as a function of depth of the traps implies a sinking rate of more than 180 meters per day. Radionuclides can be redistributed by biotic factors such as passage through the food chain, or by abiotic factors such as generation of turbulence by typhoon action. Regulatory limits for radiocesium in seafood vary among global regulators from a low of 100 becquerels per kilogram wet weight in Japan to more than 10 times that amount in the United States and the European Union. By 2015, fewer than 1% of measurements in fish had radiocesium levels above 100 becquerels per kilogram, and 80% of measurements were below the detection limit. However, even for a given date and location, measurements can vary greatly due to fish habitat, diet, size, and mobility, in addition to several abiotic factors. Sushi restaurants had best continue to diligently test their fish. Before I sign off, I want to acknowledge the half-century anniversary of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King Jr.'s speech titled Beyond Vietnam, A Time to Break Silence, delivered on 4 April 1967 at Riverside Church in New York City, 10 days after a major anti-war march in Chicago, 11 days prior to a major anti-war march from Central Park to the United Nations building in New York City, and a year to the day before he was assassinated. Besides advocating for refusal to fight by means of registration as conscientious objectors, King definitively connected the dots between the triple evils of racism, extreme materialism, and militarization. I am among those who believe that it was this speech that earned him the fatal bullet. Having done such a thorough job of celebrating MLK Day back in January, I'll not be offering further thoughts on the anniversary of the assassination when Sequitur returns the week of 9 April, hopefully to resume a bi-weekly schedule of shows. On a somewhat happier note, Thursday is the 164th anniversary of the birth of Vincent van Gogh, a great favorite of my late father's. The reproduction of the Van Gogh self-portrait that has been in my family since before I was born hangs over my desk. As a small child, before I knew he was an artist, when I asked who he was, I was told he was my Uncle Vincent. He killed himself at the age of 37, just a couple of months after having spent a year in voluntary confinement in an asylum, where he admitted himself less than 6 months after cutting off his ear, the one piece of his personal history that most people know. Check out Lust for Life, a 1934 biographical novel by Irving Stone that was made into a movie starring Kirk Douglas in 1956, for which Douglas was awarded the Golden Globe for Best Actor. Okay, that's it for now. Thanks to Deba Cale Earnshaw for the reading from William Blake, to Benjamin the Donkey for his sometimes irreverent but always enlightened commentary, and to Zimft for the Sequitur theme music. Until next time, this is Susan Livingston.
Connects us is one.